Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to Through the Smoke on Radio at Firehouse.com. We've got some very special guests with us today. The sons of the late, great FDNY Deputy Fire Chief Ray Downey. We've got with us today Joe and Chuck Downey, who are going to join us for a real intimate discussion about themselves, their dad, their family, the job, and what they want to pass on to firefighters about their dad and what their dad would have liked us to know and what we can still learn from Chief Ray Downey. But first, let's take a look at some stuff that's going on. Welcome to the new year. We hope everybody has a great 2006. Of course, last year was another bad year for all of us, as preliminary reports indicate 106 firefighters made the ultimate sacrifice in 2005. Heart attacks continue to be the leading cause of deaths. Looks like 48 firefighters lost their lives due to heart or medical conditions, and it looks like 32 firefighters died of traumatic injuries, according to the United States Fire Administration's Mark Whitney. Mark said the number of deaths will likely increase as more information is obtained. Of course, that makes sense. He'll be contacting every state's fire marshal's office to compare lists and make sure that they have the right numbers to share with us so we can learn from that. Of the brothers and sisters killed last year, 63 were volunteer firefighters, 32 were career. Off the top of my head, it looks like that's going to be the same ratio we've seen in past years. Looks like five full-time and four contract wildland fires also lost. Firefighters lost their lives. The executive director of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, Ron Sarnicky, once again, in his nationwide stomping, kicking, and screaming to stop this, is working hard, and he stated that to think that there was another firefighter death within hours of these statistics being released, and there was a Corpus Christi, Texas firefighter, a firefighter paramedic, who had a massive stroke on his way home after a 24-hour shift. While there are a number of programs out there about firefighter safety, Chief Sarnicky said getting people to accept the safety changes is another issue, and I think we all know that, and it's important that Ron keep preaching that. And I'm a big advocate that, you know, all the good stuff that the National Fallen Firefighters are doing, the IAFF is doing, the IFC is doing, the NVFC is doing, all the programs are out there are fantastic and they work. But if they don't affect and impact, basically to me, two levels of firefighters, the officer in the front seat. The officer in the front seat has almost total control of what happens to his personnel. So really, if the officer in the front seat is not embracing some of these safety changes, then it doesn't matter. You can have the greatest chief in the world, but the officer riding engine 11 or rescue 14 or truck 29, don't buy into it. It isn't going to happen. So the focus really needs to be continuing to that officer and then firefighters themselves. If a firefighter is going to let himself go as far as eating and health habits, if they're not going to train, if they're not going to try and maintain some level of physical fitness, none of this matters. So as good as this stuff is, and it is, I mean, clearly we are major advocates of reducing the numbers of firefighter death and injury. If we riding the front seat, we riding backwards, we in the offices don't make some changes, it isn't going to happen. We need to make sure that everybody comes home. Here's some preliminary statistics. 35 states reported firefighters killed in line of duty in 2005, and New York records the largest number, which is 17 lost firefighters. That replaced Pennsylvania, who was at the top of that list last year. California had 9 deaths, Texas had 8, Pennsylvania 7, and Kentucky 6. That's a major drop for Pennsylvania, and I know under the direction of Commissioner Ed Mann, they've made a major, major effort to reduce firefighter injury through education and training across that state. April was the deadliest month that killed 16 firefighters. followed by November and January, 13 each, and then 12 were killed in February and 10 in March. Looks like 27 of those who died were between the ages of 51 and 60, and those under 40 accounted for 33% of the fatalities. Also looks like stress and motor vehicle collisions also continue to be a major factors in firefighter deaths, which would mean, obviously, stress perhaps tied into the heart problem or strokes. Looks like 53% of the fatalities were emergency duty related. So the balance are those perhaps were sitting at the firehouse, maybe doing training or driving home or to work or something to that effect. Looks like 15 of the fatal incidents occurred between 1 and 3 p.m., while 14 occurred between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Looks like there were 27 on-scene deaths last year, 24 on-duty deaths, but not on an emergency scene. 17 of us were killed while responding to incidents. 14 of us lost our lives after the incident, and 13 firefighters died during training. That'll be an interesting number to look through and dig through as the numbers are tabulated. Two deaths of our own brothers and sisters occurred during arson fires, and it looks like 35 of the deaths were not incident-related. So, interesting stuff. So we appreciate that information from Firehouse.com and the United States Fire Administration. Well, in the what's called this crap never ends section of this week's show on Through the Smoke, the Cranston, Rhode Island Firefighters Union put on a demonstration of how firefighters do their job for city council members. Makes sense. They do it for, you know, show the elected officials the job we do, what we do, the equipment we wear, pulling hose lines, climbing ladders, things like that. They had their council members, the media, and the mayor's top administrators out there a few months ago in Cranston, Rhode Island for this demonstration. They all geared up, went in, etc. Beyond its intended educational value, union leaders said the demonstration made for a good time and maybe even warmed their relations with the mayor. What silly firefighters. Because a few weeks later, the union got a bill from City Hall demanding a $450 rental fee for the two pieces of apparatus from the fire department's backup fleet used that day. Union President Paul Valletta, president of Local 1363 of the IFF, said, "We've never gotten a bill for anything before. I don't know where this rental thing comes from." He called the bill, which came directly from the mayor's director of administration, an attempt by His Honor to needle the union, of which he has had a prickly relationship. An assistant City Hall bureaucrat maintained that the $450 charge was appropriate. "The union made it very clear that this was a union event," said the bureaucrat. "As such, in a sense, they were lobbying members of our city legislature. And in doing that, they used city apparatus to further a union cause," as if that's something criminal or horrible, I guess, said this young bureaucrat. Isn't that just wonderful? And for the prickly relations of the Cranston City Hall folks, the mayor and his team, we proudly award them the first of the 2006 Through the Smoke Award. We couldn't be more proud. For such brilliant relationships, leadership, and attempts on relationships, on focusing on what's best for the firefighters and the public in Cranston. With firefighters risking their lives every day, it's great to see City Hall setting such a great example with such good focus on what's important. You know, when you look through the smoke on this issue, maybe the mayor and his motivated staff ought to start charging the on-duty firefighters for the use of the firehouses, perhaps a TV charge like in hotels, and maybe even set up a front desk at each of the firehouses so the firefighters reporting to work can check in, get their room keys, and perhaps even be given a fresh, nice, hot baked cookie from the front desk clerk. On the other hand, many folks go to hotels for a short stay with one specific purpose, to get screwed, and it seems to me the Cranston firefighters in Rhode Island may fit in that category. Other items of interest this morning, and today is the 6th of January for those of you that are listening to the recording of this show. In Aurora, Indiana, three firefighters were injured when a burning two-story building on a street called Exporting Street exploded and dropped a wall and debris on the firefighters operating there. Aurora is just west of Cincinnati, Ohio. The firefighters are responding to a report of a structure fire like we all do, with occupants trapped, but the explosion and fire prevented them from entering the building. Firefighters still have not been able to get in there to conduct a thorough search for possible victims. The firefighters were trapped by a collapsed wall before being rescued. The fire was reported by a cop at 3:30 in the morning. Well, I guess the cop was on his beat, and the firefighters had it under control at 7 a.m. The firefighters who were injured were treated at the scene. Some were also transported, but it looks like everyone's going to survive, and they're in good condition. In the good stuff department, an elderly West Islip, Long Island resident was safely pulled from his burning home on Thursday, January 5th, thanks to the efforts of an off-duty volunteer firefighter. Lieutenant Al Sinati, a member of the West Islip Fire Department, was passing by the Higbee Lane house when he noticed a fire and called in the alarm on his portable radio. Lieutenant Sinati forced his way into the house through the front door and found 78-year-old Adrian Woodward in the smoke-filled room. With the assistance of Jeff Kemp, Lieutenant Sinati pulled Woodward to safety. Woodward was transported to Good Sam Hospital, where she was admitted for smoke inhalation. West Islip firefighters, along with neighboring other departments, fought the fire, which had substantial damage to the residents. You know, recently, some Long Island fire departments, or fire departments on Long Island, came under attack for some wasteful spending and response times and other issues by an area newspaper called Newsday. And while some of the issues were valid, so much of it ignored the day-to-day heroism that is displayed by firefighters on Long Island and all over this country, such as Lieutenant Al Sinati of the West Islip Fire Department. It would be nice to see Newsday have that story on their front page, but it would also be nice if I could run the Boston Marathon. I'm not sure either of those is going to happen soon. Let's move on to today's show. For those of you who may not have known Chief Ray Downey, as we start off the new year and look ahead, it's important to look back as well, to remember where we've been and determine where we're going. Whenever many of us look back in the fire business, we can't help but remember one of the finest chiefs ever, Deputy Chief Ray Downey from the FDNY. Affectionately known or referred to as the Master of Disaster and God, Ray, who was the creator and commanding officer of FDNY's Special Operations Command, who was the most highly decorated firefighter in the FDNY, was tragically murdered on 9/11/01. Chief Downey's loss, along with the other 342 firefighters of the FDNY, have left a heartfelt gap that will never, ever be filled. But yet, time does and has moved on. When we come back, we'll be spending some time with the sons of the late Chief Ray Downey, FDNY Battalion Chiefs Joe and Chuck Downey. The Downey brothers will be sharing their thoughts and feelings about their wonderful father and what he would say to those of you who didn't know him, providing the kind of advice that he would give to his firefighters, that he would give to you, to me, and to his own sons. Join in as the Downey brothers share what they think today's firefighters should do and can do to be the kind of firefighters that would have made Ray proud. So come back. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Hang on. We'll be back with Joe and Chuck Downey.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. This is the radio show Through the Smoke. For those of you who may not have known Chief Ray Downey, this week we're joined with the sons of the late Chief Ray Downey, FDNY Battalion Chiefs Joe Downey and Chuck Downey. Welcome.
Thanks, Billy. Good to be here.
Good morning, Bill.
Appreciate your time. Thanks for being here as well. I know, like all of us, everybody's busy, but we do appreciate this extremely intimate insight look at your dad through your eyes, and who better than you guys to talk about him. Joe, let's start with you. Tell us about yourself so our listeners understand who you are. Tell us from the beginning, but don't get too detailed.
All righty. I got 21 years in the fire department now. Before I got on, I was in college, finishing up college. My dad never pushed any of us to take the job. He always said to take the test and have it as a fallback. So I had taken a test during college. I had graduated college and wasn't sure what I was doing, and happened 2 months later to get a call for the fire department. So at the time, I had nothing going on. I said, I'll give it a shot. And from that point on, I loved the job, and obviously I'm still with it 21 years later. I started my career in Brooklyn in 227 engine.
Okay, and follow your career a little bit. Where'd you go from there?
Okay, I put a couple of years in the engine, and then I went to Squad Company 1, which was the only squad company at the time in Brooklyn. From there, I was promoted to lieutenant. I bounced around. My father took me back into the Special Operations Command, and bounced around for a couple of years and landed a spot in Rescue 2 as a lieutenant. Promoted from Rescue 2 and became captain. And again, my dad took me back into the Special Operations Command as a captain, and I was the captain of Squad Company 18, which is in Lower Manhattan, during the events of 9/11. A year after 9/11, I was promoted to battalion chief. I bounced around in the field for a couple months, and then I was brought back into the Special Operations Command, and now I'm a battalion chief in the Rescue Battalion.
Okay, now squad, for the interest of those who may not know, a squad, and let me see if I describe this right, a squad in FDNY is an enhanced engine company with rescue service capabilities?
Yes, and also hazmat capabilities.
Okay.
So they can just about, they're very flexible. They're called in to do just about anything.
Okay. When you were in Squad 1, was that during Bobby West time?
Yeah, sure. Bobby
I'm
West
sorry.
Was one of the senior guys there with me.
Bobby's a good guy, and he's a good friend. And
yeah.
He's got quite a reputation.
Man. Yeah.
Good reputation. You mentioned you went to college. Was that encouraged by your father, your decision, or what? Because these days when I talk to young firefighters, I tell them you need to get some courses in if you're going to promote up.
Yeah, we weren't even thinking about that. We were never volunteers, so the fire department wasn't much of the family growing up, except my dad kept everything to his heart. He never really shared much with us. So his whole idea was, you're going to college.
You know what? Can I just interject a little?
Yeah, Chuck, go ahead, because you're up next.
Yeah, no, just Joe's not mentioned being modest, but he was an all-state wrestler, and he had received a scholarship to wrestle in college as
Joe
well.
Did.
Yes, that's he's not touching on that.
Was that from having to wrestle with your father all those years?
Yeah.
Chuck, let's go to you. Talk to us.
Oh, okay. Similar situation with Joe. You know, he sent us off to college, and, you know, always stressed the academics. And I was a graduate assistant at the time coaching football in college when my investigation was going on, and I guess I probably went out into the health field for about a year as a manager in a health club before I got hired. And I was appointed to 235 engine, which is in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. And actually, the three of us were real close to each other. Joe was in squad at the time, squad one, and Dad was in rescue two. So we actually went to a lot of fires together in that area.
So I was going to ask, so the three of you had a lot of opportunities to work together. I know your dad gave me a picture years ago that shows the three of you at a job. It looked like it was right around the time they were starting bunker gear, because one of you had a really long coat on with bunker pants, and the other two had the rubber pull-up boots and the short coats, which it's a great picture.
Yeah, that's actually when I was in 235, Joe was in Squad 1, and Dad was in Rescue 2. There was a fire over in Bed-Stuy over there.
Oh.
And, I think I was wearing those bunker pants. Probably he was piloting something, and he handed us all different things.
Very good.
But,
and where are you assigned now, Chuck?
Right now, I'm a battalion chief assigned to the 13th Division, which would basically South Queens, I guess you can call it.
Okay.
It's called the UFO spot until further orders in Jamaica, Queens right now.
So you catch some work there?
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's a busy area, right?
They're one of the busiest battalions in the city, you know.
While you're working your ass off, your brother's driving around the city just looking for something to do?
he's having a lot of fun doing that, too.
Usually Chuck catches most of the work.
Okay.
You know, so, it's a busy area, and right now, you know, it's a UFO spot. Just enjoying it now.
How long have you been in the chief's? How long have you been promoted?
I've only been promoted about 15 months.
Okay, and Joe, how long have you been a chief?
A little over 3 years.
Okay, great. That's an interesting transition. Definitely going from firefighter to lieutenant, I always said, is the toughest change. But when you leave the house and you become a chief, that's a whole nother ball of wax. Chuck, what are your experiences in that that big transition from captain to chief?
I think there's definitely more stress involved. You're making a lot more decisions, but I also the positive side of it, I felt as a new lieutenant, once you go from fireman to lieutenant, you're bouncing around the city, you're working in a lot of different areas, a lot of different firehouses, a lot of different personalities. And, you know, whether it's a job, emergency, or whatever the situation, and in the firehouse, you know, those decisions, you're kind of like, okay, kind of, all right, what type of call am I going to make here? Whereas the chief, I've learned early on, is it's so much easier as a chief to make a call from the start, from the beginning, on whatever the issue is. Whether the guys look at you differently now, obviously, the guys just look at you differently, whether it's...
Well, that's a big change.
Oh, sure.
You're not part of that company anymore. That's a whole different... you're sort of up in the management level at this point, and it's... personally, it's a difficult transition. You know, it's certainly doable, and you guys are both very successful at it. But it's something that a lot of fire officers have to work through.
Sure. You know, I think, working in the areas we worked in, too, it's always good to get that experience behind you. And usually the guys, in the FDNY, it's always, where'd you work, where'd you come from, stuff like that. Guys are doing a background, the basic background check on you. So once they start hearing companies and, a lot of personalities, a lot of egos, but you get respected a lot quicker, too, with this rank.
Joe, any thoughts on the transition from firefighter to lieutenant to captain to chief?
I think mine was a little easier, having gone to the special operations and pretty much staying within special ops. I feel that the special ops is always one step ahead of the other companies, and the guys that come to these special ops realize that you need to be that way, and I'd like to say they're more disciplined. And they're all focused on the same job. So to me, it seemed quite a bit easier because I've been involved with the special ops for over 15 years.
Okay. Yeah,
so it's more comfortable.
A special ops job, I mean, in one respect of it, is to be looking out for the rest of the guys.
Exactly.
You're backing them up. You got their backs, and when they get in trouble or have a problem, that's who's coming in. Let's talk about that discipline for a minute, because anytime I hear the word discipline in FDNY, I think about your father. And... growing up, reading about him, seeing him a few times when I was on Long Island, I mentioned that I've got some dear friends in Deer Park, where your family's from, Bobby and Joey Vaccaro. Joey's at Rescue 2 now, and Bobby's retired chief at Deer Park. And having your dad jogging by, it's, my God, there he is, that's the guy. And then as I got older and got more involved, I was honored to become a part of Fire Engineering and the FDIC Advisory Board. And, of course, your dad sat on that board for years and years and got to know him. And he's like, what a great guy. And I remember him talking to me as if it was just another conversation, and just still being in awe. And 1 year at FDIC, I'm walking down the aisle with a couple of my firefighters, and he comes up. He says, Bill, I want to ask you a question. And just, I don't even remember what he asked me. I mean, what could he possibly ask me other than, do you know where the men's room is, that he would need from me? But what a wonderful man, and what a humbling guy. But I also never saw the fire and brimstone side. And let's talk about the discipline. He was known as a disciplinarian. He ran a tight ship. Joe, Chuck, whoever wants to jump in.
Are you talking about home or in the firehouse?
Yes. Wait. Let's start at home, and I hope your mom's going to listen to this recording because this will be great. Talk about at home, growing up with your father.
Well, he was a Marine, Bill, so he had that background, being a member of the United States Marine Corps. And, he had a tough childhood himself, lost his father at a very young age, and basically, worked hard growing up, all different jobs. And
grew up in Far Rockaway?
Sunnyside, Queens.
Okay, Sunnyside, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
For some reason. Did they maybe used to vacation down to the Rockaways or something?
I think,
doing a little research for this, and I found a great email on one of the memorial sites. This lady grew up with your father, and the biggest impression she had, obviously him being a well-known hero in New York, was that the two of them loved ketchup. That just stuck to me. But go ahead, tell us about life at the house with God.
Well, like we were saying, definitely disciplinary, making sure the academics were straight, you didn't talk back to him, he didn't talk back to, adults, others, just a lot of respect,
Right.
He wanted us to be, good people, good students, etc. And, in a lot of our lives growing up, academics and sports went hand in hand. So he was a great athlete, my father.
Right.
He did many different things, from hockey, marathon runner, everything he did, football when he was a kid. And he kind of pushed that with us, and, discipline went through that. We were playing sports, and to play sports and to do your academics and to stay in line, they all go hand in hand.
And then add that third leg of being firefighters. It almost is a perfect completion.
It really is, because you know, I compare it to a lot of friends who have never been in the fire service. That, you know, it's a lot like a sport. You know, you get the adrenaline going, and it's a matter of, are
right.
you going to perform or not perform? You know, and how are you going to perform? It's the stress, obviously. You know,
and the dependence upon each other.
Without a doubt, the teamwork.
Yeah.
Definitely.
You know what gets me, Bill, is the fear he put in people. You try to figure it out now, because he never fought anybody. He never hit anybody. He just demanded it in a way that it's hard to explain, because it was just the way he looked at you, the way he talked to you. You feared him in a way. Growing up, he never hit us.
No. I wish he did. Rather than get that look and his voice yelling at us, I wish he did hit me.
You get that Ray Downey stare, and it was like worse than getting beaten up.
I've got a picture of him sitting at his desk in his white shirt, and you almost don't want to look at the picture. Somebody captured him with that look that you describe. And, you know, I want to jump back for a minute. That's interesting about the military connection, the sports connection, and the fire connection. A couple weeks ago, I was saying to one of our officers regarding one of our firefighters, I said, you can tell this kid's never been in the military and he never played sports.
No kidding.
You know, I mean, you think about that. If you look at a firefighter, and I don't mean anything negatively, but a problem child, someone that doesn't seem to be fitting in,
right.
A firefighter that doesn't seem to understand the team concept.
Sure.
If you look, did he play sports? Did she play sports? Was he in the military? Was she in the military? If not, oftentimes that's a great foundation.
Yeah, it definitely helps.
Cool. Great point, Billy. Yeah.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back. We're going to talk a little bit about growing up. You mentioned about what it was like at home. We're going to talk about what it was like in the fire service at the fire department in just a minute. We'll be right back. We're talking to Chuck and Joe Downey, the sons of the late, great Chief Ray Downey.
Welcome to the latest edition of Through the Smoke with Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, addressing issues impacting all firefighters' safety, health, and morale.
We're back on Through the Smoke. This is Radio at Firehouse.com. I'm Billy Goldfeder. We got today with us Joe and Chuck Downey, Battalion Chiefs from FDNY. We've been talking about their lives growing up with their dad around the house. Let's talk about, you guys took the test, now you're firefighters. In some respects, I'm sure people listening earlier said, oh, they got great assignments because of their father and he took good care of them. But I'm going to guess, and I don't know the answer, that it was a living hell sometimes, and you maybe would have rather not been affiliated with Chief Ray Downey as firefighter. Want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I would disagree, because
okay.
It was always proud to be associated with him, and the ribbon I got at the firehouse, there was nothing substantial about it. It was very hard to say something bad about my father.
Outstanding.
You know, you get ridden because of who he was,
right,
and the things that he's done and the publicity he gets, but there was very few people that I know, if they did, they didn't say it to my face either, that would say something bad about him or what he's done.
That's great.
Obviously, they wouldn't say it to him.
End up on a hydrant thawing unit.
I'm sure there were people out there that were jealous of him,
yeah,
and what he's done and all the attention that he gets, but it was all well-deserved.
Right.
So working near him in the firehouse that I was in to start with, we'd go to jobs together and everything went well. It was
so when you guys got on the job, it maybe wasn't that big a change from life because of the sports involvement and just being around, it was just one more level of involvement to be around your dad?
Yeah, I think it was another connection as far as, you know, growing up, you know, teenage years, et cetera. They're tough years, and
right,
there's not a whole lot of communication between two meals at any level, right? But now, you know, we have sports that we, you know, that were our connection growing up, and now we had the fire department with a connection. And, you know, he just spoke to you differently. I know personally when I became on the fire department, I had you know, more of a connection to my dad again. You know, I had the sports connection growing up, but now I felt like I had another connection that, you know, he'd open up certain things to me that he wouldn't share if I wasn't on the fire department.
Which was a bit of a mystery prior, because I'm talking to you guys in the past and hearing from others and reading some of the books that were out there. When he came home, the job pretty much stayed back on the job.
Oh, without a doubt. with
that. Yeah, that was a definite. He never discussed anything with us prior to us being on a job. But then once we did get on a job, Mom used to get mad at dinner because that's all he would talk about at times. And
yeah.
Directed to Chuck and I, and we'd be talking about fires that went on, and you go to that multiple and this and that, and then Mom would be saying, well, what about everybody else here? They don't want to hear any more of that.
You tell your mom, watch the news. Here's an article. Wow, that's neat. That opened it up. And I treasure, I can't even come up with words to describe the relationship I have with my kids, but particularly since we're talking about fathers and sons, my son Brian. I can't even describe to you how important that is and how wonderful my relationship is with my son. So I'm just imagining being in your positions, knowing how you looked up to your dad from day one. Now you had the fire department connection to further open up and develop that relationship.
Yeah,
that's true. He was close to all of our siblings, not just because we were firemen.
Right.
I don't think there was a preference either way. He supported my two sisters and my younger brother also, who's a teacher.
It's five of you, right?
Yeah, there's five of us.
Two girls, three guys.
Okay. He was truly a family man, too. He loved his vacations with his family, and he made sure he made time for his family, even as busy as he was with everything. There was always time for the family, especially on holidays or birthdays or our annual vacation together.
You know, so many people forget that. A lot of firefighters get so ate up and so into the fire department that they forget about home. And again, your dad, I mean, you can almost name the subject, and your father set the example. And here's another example of him setting the tone that how important family is, and whether he spoke it or not, he knew how critical that foundation was.
That's the truth, yes.
Yeah, family vacations, you can't beat them.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit more about life as firefighters with your dad. You actually worked with him on some scenes and things like that. Did you ever see him, because I want to talk about his awards, because he never would have talked about them, so you guys are going to have to talk about them. I mean,
that would take about another 2 hours.
Well, yeah. I used to tease him when I'd see him in uniform. If you pushed him over a little bit, he'd fall from all the metal. And he was the most decorated firefighter in FDNY. If your dad was able to share some stories, which stories would he share about which awards to the firefighters that are listening in today?
Well, let me just say, Chuck could finish this one. He had done a TV show at the Fire Museum, and Chuck actually asked this one similar question to him.
Okay,
so maybe Chuck could go over. You remember that question you asked Chuck?
Yeah, sure. Like Joe was saying, it was a, I can't think of Sandy's last name. You remember Sandy's last name?
Sanzervino?
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. So there was a show at the Fire Museum, and you know, they interviewed Dad, and at the end they asked people to go online and just ask questions. And I had asked him, which I had never asked him prior to that. And I guess, Joe, what year was that? Do you remember?
No, I don't recall.
1999 maybe, or 2000. I asked him, I said, well, you know, what was your most vivid memory of the best job that you had, you know, as far as firefighting? And he talked about a job that he had at a tenement when he was in Fort Truck.
What's a tenement for those who don't know?
A tenement could be anything from three to seven stories, non-fireproof, you know, class 3 brick and joist building.
So basically a large apartment building.
Yeah, but not too large, like you know, four windows across max, you know,
okay,
25.
Multiple family dwelling.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, not a real big one like an H type, but you know, narrow one. And he spoke of this job, which was like I said, in the 1960s, he was in Ford Truck, a firefighter, and it was real tough getting the roof, and, you know, they made a bunch of grabs that day, and it was just a real snotty, rotten job, and they saved a lot of lives, and that was the one he spoke about. I think it was his, Joe, if I'm not mistaken, it was his first medal.
Yeah, I don't even know if he got a medal at that one, Chuck.
Daily
I think what he said was he got the roof.
Right.
He didn't even, I don't think he even made a grab. He didn't make a rescue, but he made it to the roof and vented for the guys.
It was locked up real bad. It was, you know, it was just
by opening up, he saved a lot of lives.
He saved the fireman, he felt, yeah. But he didn't. I don't think he got awarded for anything, but he said that was probably his biggest challenge.
Right.
Throughout his career, in which he definitely saw many challenges.
Oh. Which ones do you guys remember? Like, holy crow! I mean, I would love to be able to do that someday. Which award do each of you remember specifically, and certainly you were on hand for the many medal days, either as youngsters, teenagers, young adults, or young firefighters, when he got some of these. Do you have anyone in particular that just stands out, Joe?
No. When I got, he had received, I think, his last medal, like when I had a year on a job. And I believe that was when he was off duty going to work, and he had saved people across the street from the firehouse. But he never hopped on his medals. My best experience would be something that I had with him at a fire,
okay,
working together,
right,
moving a line down together, and you know, going to a couple floors of fire.
Just working with him.
Him directing the line with me on it.
Yeah.
And then moving it. That's my most memorable job with him. And like I said, it wasn't talked about at home about his
right,
medals. We read about him.
Right.
And after he died, we got his meritorious book I got from work and all his write-ups and went through them, and they were all pretty outstanding.
Yeah, unbelievable. Chuck, comment?
Yeah, it's Joe hit it. It wasn't really talked about as far as the awards and the medals, but it's the jobs that I truly remember, the couple jobs I had moving in or, you know, standing outside. I remember one multiple alarm. I was a probie, and it was, I think they had three wood frame buildings going about four stories high, and all three of them it ended up a fourth alarm. But I remember us pulling up on the second or third alarm, I forget what, and he popped out of his head out of a third floor window, fire below him, pushing out. It had to be about 15 windows on the front between the three buildings, just pushing out, fire out of multiple windows through the roof, and just see him pop his head out through the smoke and barking out some orders, telling the chief what was going on, and he disappeared. And I said, holy crap.
As a lieutenant or captain, it wasn't unusual for him to provide direction to chiefs, was it?
No, and his voice was very distinctive.
Yes.
Even outside, you know, everybody went, when he pulled up, it was directed towards him, what he thought should be done. And then inside, when you're working with him, his voice was so distinctive, everybody had that muffled mass voice on, and you could just hear him in there giving orders to everybody on what needed to be done, and in a, you know, very calm manner, but distinctive voice saying, this is what's going to get done, and let's do it.
Yeah.
And moved on.
And that kind of calm but solid leadership can make such a difference. You know, you listen on the radio wherever you may be, and you'll hear a chief or an officer get on the scene screaming and yelling,
It
just, the whole incident goes straight to hell.
Without a doubt.
And then you hear another officer pull up, and it's cool, calm, and collected. It sets the tone.
Oh, it certainly does.
For how that job's going to go. And your dad was a great example of that. All right, we're going to be back in just a couple minutes, take a quick break for a few words, and then we'll be back and talk a little bit about the book, The Rescue Company, Physical Fitness, and some advice to firefighters from the Downey Brothers. We'll be right back.
Is it sometimes a little hard to see through the smoke? Do fire service, rescue, and EMS issues work you up just a bit? Maybe more than just a bit? If they don't, check your pulse. It's normal for firefighters and responders to get worked up over hot issues when you love the job so much. Deputy Fire Chief Billy Goldfeder, Firehouse.com commentator and Firehouse Magazine columnist, hosts Through the Smoke, an internet broadcast and podcast that addresses issues impacting all firefighters, such as safety, health, and morale. Don't ignore the issues and maintain the status quo. Take an interest in issues that impact you, the frontline responder. Join Billy, special guests, and firefighters around the country and the world regularly on Through the Smoke, only on Firehouse.com.
We're back with Chuck and Joe Downey, FDNY Chiefs, sons of the very popular, highly respected, and well-known Chief Ray Downey, who was tragically murdered on 9/11. We were talking about awards. If there's one award, and I know sometimes getting information on a personal side from your dad was like pulling teeth, but if there's one award, maybe he shared something. Was there one that he loved in particular that he was really proud of that probably he wouldn't have told many people about?
Yeah, I would have to say it was the Crystal Apple Award, which is given out annually by Mayor Giuliani for an outstanding citizen. Usually it goes to somebody of high profile, an actor or somebody in a political circle. And this year, that year, it was 2001,
right,
a couple months before he was killed, where he was going to get the award at Gracie Mansion. And when we first found out, it was kind of joking at Downey House. It was like, why is he getting it?
And what did he do?
And I think we all asked him that. Like, it's when my mom called and said, we're going to Gracie Mansion for the award. And I'm like, when we saw Dad, we're like, why, though? Why are they giving it to you? And pretty much he said, I don't know. he couldn't give us an answer. But the reason why I felt, or he felt probably was the proudest award, was obviously the mayor was honoring him. And they were allowing him to bring his family and friends. It wasn't a political thing. There weren't politicians there. There wasn't fire department brass there. It was only the people that Ray Downey wanted to invite.
That's a big deal.
Yeah.
It was.
No uniforms. There was no uniforms.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
So it really set the tone, though, for him to allow, I mean, for him to be honored with those he cared about the most.
Yeah, it was. It was definitely what he told Mom was the pinnacle of his career. You know, he didn't know where it could go from here. He seemed to do everything that he'd like to have done. He's done in his life, and then for the mayor to honor him, it was a great night, too. It was a fantastic night.
Unbelievable. That's great. You know, I just want to jump back on the leadership issue, and I had the privilege of growing up a couple of years behind Lee Ielpe, who your dad, of course, worked with the rescue too, and Lee also a very heroic and highly respected firefighter. Lee lost his son Jonathan from Squad 288 on 9/11. But I remember talking to Lee and John just a few weeks prior to 9/11 about the Father's Day fire, and they're describing to me your dad arriving on that scene as well, and that's what I couldn't help but think about. When you guys talked about his arrival on an emergency and how that calmed things, it settled things down, and clearly disorder became order. And that's no slam to anybody else who was operating on any scene, but I think that that fire when Harry Ford, John Downing, and Brian Fahey lost their lives, were either of you on that scene, or are you familiar with that?
Chuck was in Rescue 4. Neither of us were there. We were actually going to Dad's house for Father's Day.
Yeah, I was actually working, you know, getting off duty.
And, okay.
Yeah, but no, I wasn't. I didn't work that
okay,
job.
But that was just. Would you agree that it's just one more example of he's arrived on the scene. Now we're going to straighten this out as best we can.
Oh yeah, we've heard stories. Chuck and I went to the firehouse that night to visit with the guys because I had been an officer in their Rescue 4 and Chuck was a firefighter in Rescue 4, so we knew most of the guys.
Okay.
And we had worked with Harry and Brian, so we had gone there, and obviously the stories were told again. You could see as we walked through the apparatus door, his eyes were bloodshot red, my father's.
Yeah.
You
right.
could see he took a beating and a half, and they said that he went into the building and stood there the whole time until Brian was removed from the cellar, he himself tried to get down there to get him out.
Outstanding, but there's that calm leadership again, being
right.
the foundation to turn a mess into something as positive as possible. He was involved in the writing of a book, The Rescue Company. I think it was, is that published by Penwell? Did they publish
yes,
that book?
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk just a little bit about that book. I was looking at, you guys, I think, know Chief Frank Montagna. Frank has a website, chiefmontagna.com, and it's in his list of 10 books you must read as a firefighter.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And well, of course, Frank, and only the way Frank could say it, if you're starting a rescue company, read this book. And that was his review. It was great. But talk about that a little bit. Do you remember much about that and him putting that book together? I mean, you wouldn't think this rough, tough guy would be the one to put a book out.
Well, it came out, what, 92, if I'm not mistaken.
It's been around for a while, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was 92.
It truly is a guide.
It is. It's a hands-on guide. It's everything that he learned hands-on. It's nothing he read about or from other people or researched it. Everything that he put in that book is what he experienced with his guys.
So basically, if for those who are listening to the show, and we're not selling books here, but the fact of the matter is, if you want to learn more about Chief Ray Downey from a tactical standpoint and the things he believed in and the things he taught, get the book. And it seems to make the most sense. Let's talk on a little bit more about advice to firefighters. I mean, we've talked so much about your dad and information or informing our listeners about who he was and the kind of person he was. And hopefully by now, if they didn't already, they've got a much clearer picture through the eyes and the mouths of his sons, Chuck and Joe, and through the hearts. But what would your dad today be teaching firefighters post 9/11? And I'm an advocate of absolutely we have to be prepared for terrorism, weapons of mass destruction, but we also can't forget the basics. Mm. And so many fire departments are sending firefighters everywhere and anywhere for WMD terrorism training, but yet they haven't been taught how to stretch a line properly. So maybe you guys want to share a little bit about where you think your dad would be. Certainly you've had some moments to yourselves thinking, man, if Dad were here, he'd suggest this or he'd want to see this happen on a larger scale. Any thoughts on that, guys? Chuck?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different issues. That I think, like you said, yeah, WMDs, terrorism, definitely in this day and age. And, Dad had also, I don't know if you're familiar with the Gilmore Commission, Billy.
Where he testified.
Right.
Yes. Yeah, share that with the readers, because that's incredible.
Right.
He did some predicting.
That was a classic, like you said, prediction. He didn't say, I'm trying to think of the exact line that he said.
But I think it was something to the effect of, it's not if we're going to be attacked, it's when we're going to be attacked, and we're not prepared.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And
if you need any quotes that your dad said, just let me know.
Press your button.
I've studied him. He's
right.
Just a great guy. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. So I mean, obviously, he knew and he felt strongly about what was going to happen, and just being special ops out of his 39 and a half years. Let's see, he was in special ops. Probably 30, Joe, 30 plus. No,
right.
Over 30. Yeah, over 30. So I mean, just all the special. He was always, when all the new squads came along, he was behind that. And there was money for hazmat. There was a need for the technician units, and there was, it was his way of making special ops grow and getting bigger and
right.
doing more for the FDNY and, the citizens of New York. So he was, he was way ahead of everyone else in how he thought.
The nation, sure.
Oh, without a doubt.
I don't think he ever lost focus, though, on the day-to-day responsibilities of a firefighter.
No, definitely not.
I mean, in special operations, you're doing hazmat training, you're doing WMD terrorism, but you're still doing fire training too for your companies, right? I mean,
yeah, I think that's the Joe touched it before. The unique, not putting anyone else down or any other city or any other company in the FDNY, but in special ops, rescue squads and hazmat, there's no downtime. If you're not going to work or if you're not responding, you're training, and I think that's unique about special ops is, you're training. Every now and then, you wish you need that downtime to lay down or something, but not in special ops. They're constantly training, and if they're responding, they're always doing something.
I was in the city a couple months ago, and then visiting with a friend of mine, and the conversation came up just on what you're talking about, how there really can't be downtime. There's always something to train on. There's always a tool you can review. And the comment was that he had stopped by, this happened to be a chief, he stopped by Rescue 1 at like 2:30 in the morning, and Captain Morris had the crews training in the firehouse.
Yeah.
And nobody knew this chief was coming by.
Right.
No, you don't have to do that in those companies, especially Captain Morris. He never stops. But that's just with all our companies. And I think when my dad, if he was around now, he'd be extremely proud of what they've continued with the resources and the manpower that we have. Obviously, there's a lot of less experienced guys around now than there were prior to 9/11, but they still have the heart and dedication and motivation to get the job done. And like Captain Morris, he knows he's got some new faces, and he'll be drilling all day with them.
Right.
When they're working, they're working.
Well, somebody said that, and I can't directly quote him, he said, but they're paying us to be here for 24 hours. What else would we be doing? And that, you know, in some places, you knock on the door of the firehouse at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they're sleeping. They're unconscious in the recliners.
And then
people wonder, well, what happened at that fire? We didn't do as well. You know, this crew didn't know what to do. And that's a refreshing attitude, and that's an attitude that needs to be taken by more and more officers. And, you know, your firefighters are going to bitch at you. They're going to whine and complain in some cases. But if you're a good enough officer, you'll motivate them. You'll get rid of that, and they'll be begging for more training.
That's true. And
spending more time doing that.
Definitely.
That's true. I think his philosophy, too, was hands-on. Being a young guy coming to the rescue company and the squad companies, when you first got there, they told you, you stay on that rig until you know every tool and how to use it. Take it apart, put it together. And then when you do that, then you can take a break. And that takes probably 2 years to do that. But that was the philosophy of every company.
They allow you in the kitchen after 2 years.
Yeah. And then at that point, a new guy comes in, and you're out of the kitchen showing a new guy.
Right.
So that's why the constant training, the constant reinforcements. And like you said, you might be sharp with the Hurst tool or the wizard, but, you know, you might not have used it in a year and a half.
Exactly. You know, we talk about company officers, and I mentioned at the beginning of the show how I consider that the toughest job or the toughest position on the job is that company officer, the first-line supervisor. But so many officers, basically what you guys are talking about, which is that Ray Downey philosophy, the officer's got to understand that every firefighter riding on your apparatus, whether you're on a rescue company, a squad, an engine, a truck, every firefighter riding or potentially riding on that rig has got to be an expert on every tool or task that company may be called to use or be asked to perform.
Right.
And if you're not constantly training, it ain't going to happen. What about thoughts on FEMA? And you know, there's a lot of, I don't want to put you in too tight a spot, but what advice would your dad be giving to Dave Paulson, who's a wonderful guy and a good friend, and thank God we have a firefighter at the head of FEMA right now.
Right.
He certainly has his hands full trying to fix that bureaucracy. There's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
But what would your advice be to Dave and to the FEMA folks based upon some of the things we've seen happen since 9/11? Some good and, unfortunately, some bad.
Joe's a task force leader, so I think he could definitely hit this subject for you.
But look at your brother step back on that.
Yeah. No, it's...
That's right. It's appropriate. Go
obviously,
ahead.
When you're dealing with DHS and FEMA, you're dealing with the government and a lot of political issues involved behind it. We're involved with the urban search and rescue end of it.
Right.
So I could comment on that.
Please do.
And my dad was one of the members put together to put this system together back in 92.
Right. He was one of the creators of the USAR.
He was
a
force behind the creation of these teams. And I think his idea then and now would be the same, is to have these specialized resources throughout the country, 28 teams dispersed throughout the country, to respond to major disasters and help out. Everybody's trained to the same level, same positions, it's uniform, and they're ready to go at a moment's notice. I don't know if they're used properly at times, and I think that's a political issue.
Right.
I think that there was some issues down at Katrina and Rita where originally there wasn't enough resources deployed and then too many resources deployed. So I guess there's got to be that balance. I think it's a great resource to be used more often. And for any kind of major disaster, the teams, like I said, are well trained, and I think most of them still thank my dad for that. I have the opportunity to go to meetings now and meet the other task force leaders throughout the country, and they're always commenting on how my dad was a major force. They call him the godfather behind the system of making things happen. And like you said earlier, he didn't take no for an answer. He found solutions to problems. If they say we can't do it this way, well, let's go to the drawing board, and we're going to find another way that we can do it, and we're going to get it done. And within the system that I see now, I've been involved for 2.5 years as a task force leader, it's a constant battle. And I'm not up on the political end of it, but it just seems that there's people in that circle that aren't familiar with responders, operations level, and they make decisions that they probably shouldn't make decisions.
Not unlike someone at a city hall or a city manager's office attempting to micromanage the way the fire department is supposed to operate.
I think you're exactly right, Bill. Like I said, I'm not at that level. We're sort of the grunts to get things done.
Sure.
And we're told what to do, and if we can do it this way, all right. If we got to adapt and overcome, then we do that. and they get it done. I thought I was down at Katrina, and I operated down there with New York Task Force 1, and the job that I saw the task forces do down there, trying to locate the people that needed help, was tremendous. They worked hard. The conditions weren't the greatest. Nobody complained. They just did what they were asked of.
It seems the USAR teams, the task forces, and our crew from Ohio was down there, and there was a number of teams down there, obviously. That seems to work. It really does. If you leave them alone, they know what to do. Not unlike the firehouse. Leave the firefighters alone. Let them operate on this scene. Don't interfere with the budgets. Don't screw with them as far as responses, and the job will get done. It's really like a big fire department.
That's the truth. I have to agree with you there.
Big response. So, good. All right. Look, we're going to come back for our final segment. We're going to talk about 9/11. We're going to talk a little bit about that day and what's happened since then as we discuss the spirit and the mission of Chief Ray Downey when he was alive and his continuing spirit and mission after he's passed on. We'll be right back with Chiefs Joe and Chuck Downey.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
For those of you who may not have known Chief Ray Downey, you certainly have gotten to know Ray better today through his sons, Chuck and Joe, sharing just some outstanding stories and information about the late, great Fire Chief Ray. Let's talk about 9/11. To even say we'll never forget is that goes without saying, I guess. But let's talk specifically about Ray. Where was he? Because this is what people are interested in hearing, and they've heard about his beginnings, they've heard about his career, and now they want to hear where he was. What happened that day, as far as his concern? Where was he when the call came in, guys?
All right, you want me to take it, Chuck?
Oh, yeah, it doesn't. Go ahead.
He was, as usual, in SOC command. I don't know, just touch on his daily routine. It was he got up at 4:30 every morning, went to SOC, went out for his run before work, and started his day at 7 o'clock. So he was there that morning when he got the call with the other chiefs at the Special Operations Command, the chiefs relieve at 7 o'clock. So there was an on-duty chief, an off-going chief, my dad, plus another chief had come in, so there was four of them there. When the call came in, they all went to the scene. He drove through the Midtown Tunnel to get to the Trade Center, and on arrival, he was met at the command post, and I think if you ever saw that video, you'll see him at the command post talking.
The video that the French brothers took?
Right, right.
Yeah, right.
You'll
right.
see him briefly come into the command post
right.
and operate there, and then as Chief Gansey and Assistant Commissioner Feehan were there, he operated with them on the outside command post.
Okay.
And once the first building had collapsed, the South Tower came down, they were right across the street from the North Tower. They went into the building across the street into their parking garage and escaped the collapse. And from just witnesses that Chuck and I know, friends, said before the smoke had even cleared, he was on his way out of the rubble, getting back into the
Not
scene.
Not surprising.
Yeah.
So he had come out, and he went right to the front of the North Tower on the radio looking to get the rest of the guys out of the tower. And he was outside the North Tower, the Marriott at the time, with Chief Larry Stack.
Right.
And two members of the Special Operations Command who were supposed to be at the training center came out of the Marriott and got a piece of, my dad gave him a piece of his mind of why they were there. These were the last two gentlemen. They were both lieutenants, John Citarella and Steve Torelli. They were the last two people to see him. And once they came out, my dad ripped into him for being there and then told him.
Self-deployment was an issue with your father.
It was. It was. And even at that point with everything, all the chaos, he knew that they weren't supposed to be there, that their job was at the training center.
Yeah.
So he gave him a little piece of his mind, like I said, and told him to get out of there. I can't use the words on the radio right now. And to head north. What they said, there was an elderly gentleman, a heavyset man that was stuck still, and he was at their feet on the other side of, you could picture, a wall. And my dad and then Chief Larry Stack stayed with this guy and waited. While they were waiting there, they were calling other people to come out of the tower, and never moved from that point. And that was the last we heard of what his operations were.
Okay.
And the tower came down.
Where, Chuck, anything to add to that?
No, that's like okay. Joe said, basically what those guys had told us, you know, the last two to see him. Besides the other people that he directed before.
Prior to that.
Prior to that, yeah, many people he directed north.
Where were each of you that day?
I was in my backyard, working in my backyard at home.
This is Chuck speaking?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and I was just at home putting the kids on the bus.
Okay, so you both were home.
Yeah.
And then it unfolded as the day went on, and obviously you both responded in.
Yeah. By the time I guess we got our gear and got down there, I don't know when we saw each other. Around noon, a little before noon.
Yeah, maybe even a little later.
But I don't even remember the exact time.
Okay.
Yeah, we both responded as soon as we saw it on TV. We both responded in.
Right.
My company was Squad Company 18 at the time. And I knew they would be there. And when I got to the scene, which was after, you know, both buildings had come down, I had seen Chief Crothers.
Right.
And I went up to him right away, and I said, I haven't heard from my dad. Sock hasn't heard from him. Have you seen him? And pretty much what he did was just kind of put his head down and walk away from me. And at that point, I knew that he was missing. You know, he was one of the... We didn't realize that many guys.
Right, some sense of reality was starting to set into you.
It was pretty chaotic in the beginning there, and you didn't know who was working at the scene, who was around, who was just responding in. It was a mess.
Plus the geographical area that was involved.
Just so huge.
So huge. So yeah. Enormous, you know.
And my daughter... Danny was just in New York last week, and Leah Elpe took her and her friends for a tour.
Right.
And that's what they came back, and they said that 16 acres. How could you even manage that?
But
it was a large-scale situation. Well, we understand, and we certainly know what happened after that. But let's move on to something positive that's come from this. This horrible, and I refer to it in my writings and my speaking as murders, because that's exactly what this was.
That's
thousands of wonderful Americans and others visiting our country who were killed too, were murdered by these bastards.
Definitely.
We continue to, at least I do, continue to scratch my head about why and how and could, but we'll move on from that. His spirit lives on. Your dad physically is gone, but there is so much Ray Downey stuff going on out there. That's such a good filler word. It works all the time. And firefighters who weren't even on the job know who Ray Downey is because of the wonderful things he's done. You know, he even got some awards after 9/11. Can you guys talk about that? And then I want to wrap up with you guys. And I need our listeners to get some paper and pencil out because you're going to have to write some stuff down, because we got some great information to share with you about several scholarships that are out there that are in Ray's name and honor. But first, let's talk about what awards and recognitions did he get after his tragic passing?
I think maybe Joe and I would just go back and forth, whatever pops ahead.
Go ahead. Yeah.
As far as awards, and I mean, one that comes right to my head right away is what Fire Engineering did. They created the Ray Downey Courage and Valor Award in his honor, and they actually, my mother received the award the first year, and you know, they just it's given to an extra, you know, a courageous American firefighter or their family for what they performed in the line of duty. That's one award. And Joe, if you want to, we could keep going back and forth.
Let me just touch on that since we're talking about that now. Listeners, on your screens with this radio show, if you look, you should see a link in the show description at the bottom. That's www.courageandvalor.com. And we're going to let the Joe and Chuck, I want you guys to talk about that award before we wrap up, so people can learn how they can have put names in for that stuff. But go ahead.
Sure. The other award, which was something Theater is Hot, was the Marine Corps renamed their CBRF training facility. CBRF is their Chemical Biological Incident Response Force. They have a training facility down in Stump Neck, Maryland. And my dad had created a training, interacting training with the Marine Corps, that he would bring the Marines up and train them in technical rescue. Back, I think it started in 96, and it was an ongoing thing. After 9/11, one of the colonels contacted us and asked if we would mind if they renamed their training facility after him.
Right.
And my dad was a Marine at heart. He never put us into the military, but we saw how he loved the Marine Corps. And to go down to Stump Neck, Maryland, as a family, once again, they treated us like gold, and they have a fantastic training facility, all technical rescue stuff, that is renamed the Ray Downey Responder Training Facility. And hopefully in the future, they were talking that the Marines will be training many members of the different services down there in technical rescue.
Outstanding. What else you want to share with us?
Chuck, the Distinguished Navy Award?
That's what I was just going to touch. May of 2002, he received the Distinguished Naval Award from the military once again. It was on the Iwo Jima, right, Joe?
Yes.
The Iwo Jima down at on the west side of Manhattan. Colonel, all brass from the military. It was a real nice award ceremony. They honored Dad with that award that went to, you know, he's considered, although he was in the military, he's still considered a civilian at this time once you leave your civilian. But, you know, another huge, huge award that I consider.
Outstanding.
Yeah, the post office in Deer Park was renamed after him.
In his hometown.
In his hometown of Deer Park. Named the post office.
And then there's so many, you know, awards at universities, Stony Brook and Hofstra, at the high school level, you know, the Ray Downey MVP, the Ray Downey Outstanding Wrestler Award, and, I mean, they really are endless, Bill.
He'll never be forgotten. I mean, his work has created this, and these recognitions are reminding people. So, you know, 100 years from now, some kid getting this scholarship is going to know who Ray Downey was.
Right.
That's important. Let's talk about the scholarships. Because again, Ray was such a giving person. That's his whole life was giving. He gave to his country as a Marine. He gave to the city of New York as a firefighter. He gave to the country as basically the father of the USAR teams.
Right.
And now, even though he's gone, he continues to give. Talk about, and the two awards that I'm most familiar with is the Courage and Valor Award and also the Chief Ray Downey Charity Scholarship Fund.
Right.
And that's tied into the run, correct?
Yes.
That's the same thing. So let's talk about the run, the Chief Ray Downey Charity Scholarship Fund. What's that for? When is it? How can people become involved and things like that?
Okay, we do it. It's an annual Father's Day run. And like you said, it's called the Deputy Chief Ray Downey Scholarship/Charity Fund. All the funds raised on Father's Day that day, it's going to be our fifth annual. This June will be the fifth one. Since its inception, we've given out over $100,000 to approximately probably 30, 40 different organizations and individuals, you know, ranging from, you know, diabetes to scholar athletes at the high school to...
All in your father's name.
Oh, yeah, New York Burn Center, you know, firefighter transport. Just, you know, the list is endless, and we do that run once a year, and that's just for that fund itself. Ray Downey Scholarship Charity Fund. It's on Father's Day. It's one of the biggest races, 5K races in the whole metropolitan area. As far as, you know, we have over 1,500 runners / walkers each year.
That's great. And that's chiefraydowney.org is the website I'm seeing here.
.com, www.chiefraydowney.com.
Or .org. You can get it either one.
Okay. Oh, great. Okay.
You can get either one. And just
we're going to link it on the website here. So.
Just to let people know, Bill, it's not just a 5K run. It's a family day. We pride ourselves on having the family start their Father's Day together. We have bouncies for the kids. We have a DJ with entertainment. We give out thousands of dollars worth of raffle prizes where you don't even have to buy a raffle ticket. All you got to do is be part of the race. We have a children's fun run, no charge. Children get medals. They get water bottles. They got ice cream, cotton candy. We give away a lot, like you said earlier, for the fact that my dad has given all his life. So we feel as a family, which this run is totally run by the family.
Okay.
It's our siblings, our mom, and friends from the neighborhood that put this run on. And we'd like to give back to everybody else.
So instead of I'm in Ohio or someone's listening in California, up in Canada, wherever, maybe instead of the traditional Father's Day at home, where you're going to get a tie and have dinner and then go back to watching the game on TV, maybe this is an opportunity, and it's early enough for families to plan on a trip to New York and come see the city, maybe go pick a, go grab tickets to a Broadway show, but on Father's Day, plan on coming to Long Island and spending it with the Downey family.
It's a great day, and like Joe said, we provide from local merchants everything from, you know, hot dogs, hamburger, everything is free. Beer, even beer. We got a beer truck that comes in. Everything's free. Then we'll get some firemen that way.
Yeah, we got to get the beer, but we'd love to have people from everywhere to That's come in and run our race.
And we do get, you know, we get people from out of state coming in all the time, and
This is a fundraiser in your dad's name. Where the money is given to various needy organizations throughout the year.
Yeah, and what was a good thing for Mom, because it kept her busy, too. She's the president of the scholarship fund, and pretty much she decides on where a lot of the money goes, and most of the times it's things that were dear to my mom and dad.
That's
where
fantastic.
The money to.
Yeah. Now, let's jump back to the Courage and Valor Award that is given out every year at FDIC. On behalf of Penwell and Fire Engineering. And I appreciate, by the way, and I want to say that this show is on a competitive host, Cygnus, of course, Firehouse Magazine and Firehouse.com. But they're good folks, and they've always given me the freedom to share whatever we need to. And in this case, we're going to talk a little bit about that award and FDIC and the recipients. And who can apply? How can we get people interested? And not that that's a problem, but a firefighter in Michigan or a chief in New Mexico who realizes that one of his or her firefighters did something special, how do they apply or send the paperwork in for the Courage and Valor Award, the Ray Downey Courage and Valor Award?
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways. You can go to www.courageandvalor.org.
Or .com. I think it works both ways,
Does
right?
it work both? Okay.
Yeah. Well, if it doesn't, we're going to make it work on this website.
And like I know it's firehouse.com, but Fire Engineering, you know, each monthly issue, there's a Ray Downey Courage and Valor Award nomination form that they can fill out and send in.
Good.
It's all self-explanatory, and, you know, those are just two ways to get a form into this.
And who reviews these, and what are you looking for the recipients of this Courage and Valor Award?
There's a committee through, I believe it's the National Fallen Firefighters, that looks at it first, fire engineering to them, and then the final decision is made by Mr. Bianchini, who's the president of Penwell.
Okay.
His son and an associate, and Chuck and I sit in on it.
Very nice.
And we look at it, and what we're trying to do is, what Chuck and I have picked, or we've nominated over the last couple of years, are things that resemble my dad's life, possibly rescues that he was involved with or sacrifices that he was happened to him. And we've had three fantastic recipients in the last 3 years, and we're looking to do more with it because there are so many great rescues out there that are never seen. I know you have a lot on your website through the
firefighterclosecalls.com.
Right, and the secret list comes out, and you read about these rescues and sacrifices and courage. And we're just looking to get those people that, if they experience that, to send it in. The deadline for this one is January 14th.
Okay,
so it's right around the corner.
So those of you that are listening, if you click the link, courageandvalor.com, download that paperwork and get it in quickly, it's still not too late, right?
Yeah, it's just a brief little history. You know, the form is self-explanatory. And, you know, like Joe said, we had some great recipients. There was Derek Martin, who tried to rescue a fellow firefighter in St. Louis that, you know, died in the line of duty.
Right.
There was John Taylor from Philadelphia, another one trying to rescue a fellow firefighter in the basement of a bomb, you know, and died in the line of duty. And, we want to get, you know, the word out, because there's a lot of great actions and deeds being done out there. We just want, you know, the recognition for some others.
Outstanding. We're going to start wrapping this up. Are there any other scholarships we should be aware of?
Yeah, we have two at our universities. Chuck went to Stony Brook University, and as I said earlier, an All-American football player, and they established a football scholarship. in my dad's name at Stony Brook University. And also Hofstra University, where myself and my younger brother Ray went to school, they established a wrestling scholarship. And by doing this, once a year, they have either a football game or a wrestling match where they acknowledge our dad, and money is raised, and that money is used for both teams to bring in athletes into their programs.
Another area important to your father is the athletics.
Oh.
Sports, yeah.
Yeah. They're...
Outstanding. Man, it's everything he was involved with, the military, there is now an active program honoring your father. The fire department, there's an active program honoring your father. And in the sports community, there's active programs honoring your father. You know, it's kind of hard to find anything else that he has not touched, and that certainly says a lot about your father.
Yeah, that's
outstanding. Well, I made a few notes here that I want to wrap up with that might describe Ray. But before we do that, I want to give each of you guys a minute for some final comments to our listeners. Chuck, a couple of final words as a recap of the show.
We spoke a lot about Dad and all his different aspects of life, from the fire department to sports to the military, and, family being most important to him. You know, family's always number one. For any new guys coming on the job, I took out, my father wrote me a 16-step list of being a probie when I was a probie, and I actually had it laminated after he paid, he was killed on 9/11, and I just want to read maybe just...
No, I'm going to ask you to read all 16.
Well, the last four or five are real good, because I think number 12, when at fire, is listen for your officer's instructions. 13, always stay with your company. 14, at fire, stay low. And then 15 and 16 kind of sum it all up as for probie, but probably for all new guys coming in. Keep your mouth shut and your eyes and ears open. And the last one, never give up.
Outstanding.
So I just want to the background on him and how he, felt towards the job. I have his book right in front of me, The Rescue Company, and, he said, just one little sentence from it, always keep a positive attitude towards the job. I've enjoyed over 30 years, and he goes, I wish I could do another 30 with you and your brother. So, positive attitude.
You know, it's so easy for firefighters to get upset or, whining or pissed off or whatever, but, there was an editorial years and years ago in Fire Chief Magazine, I'll never forget it, and it said that the federal government ought to give every firefighter a free year's vacation. But they had, not a free year, a 1 week out of every year vacation, I'm sorry. 1 week out of every year free, paid for by the federal government. But you had to go back and live your life for that week before you were a firefighter. And they said that so many morale issues would go away, because our worst day is wonderful.
Right.
And we have such a good job. And it doesn't matter, career or volunteer. Most volunteer firefighters I know are volunteer firefighters first, and then they go to their jobs to make money so they can go back and be a good volunteer firefighter.
Right.
And career firefighters, it's a lifestyle for all of us, whether it be career, volunteer, whatever it is. And that positive attitude is so important.
Yeah.
Not only does it affect each other, but it affects the job we do. So those points are great. Joe, how about from you?
That was good. My comments are, what my dad would want to see done now is keep preparing for the unknown. Obviously, he was ahead of the game while he was the chief in special ops, and some programs that he wanted to start back then are just coming to New York City now. I think we got to keep prepared. Obviously, the everyday fire duty is down, and that's why we got to work harder on being ready for just your normal jobs. And then again, with our special ops, we're moving ahead with all kinds of different programs, and I think he would be extremely proud of that. He always led by example, so like Chuck said, you keep your mouth shut, you lead by example, other people will follow you. And he was always up for the challenge, and I think our New York City is up for the challenge right now, and pretty much we're doing okay.
And Moving forward. Outstanding. Well, I made some words here I want to share, and we're about done. But some words that I picked up to recap the discussion today, this is a team. We're a team, and it's not about me as a firefighter. It's about you taking care of your brothers and sisters in order to function as a team. There's no downtime, and I know that's going to send some people into seizures listening to that. But it makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, we're here, whether it's a volunteer department and you're down there for your weekly training, make sure every minute is spent training, some good quality, no bullshit training, to make sure that every tool on the apparatus can be managed by every firefighter as an expert, and any task that that company can be assigned to, they handle with total confidence because they've been trained. The no downtime, hands-on training. Like you said, when a firefighter started in your dad's firehouse, he gave them 2 years to learn the tools, and they weren't allowed to sit down for 2 years. It says so much about the kind of guy he was. Never forget where he came from. His sports background, his military background created the fire chief that he is, and most importantly, not forgetting your family. And we all do from time to time. It's easy to love the job, love being a firehouse, go hang out at the firehouse. But I'll tell you, well after the job is thanking you, it's your family that's counting on you and still loving you. And I've certainly learned that, and I'm very blessed with a Brady Bunch here at my house. And it makes all the difference in the world. We want to thank Chuck and Joe Downey, Battalion Chiefs from the FDNY, for sharing with us such personal and intimate information and insight about their wonderful father, Chief Ray Downey, who was tragically murdered on 9/11, but continues to live on today through their words, through the scholarships, through his actions, basically through his life. Thanks so much for listening, and Joe and Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us, Bill.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.